Welcome to the Motley Fool Radio Show. I'm David Gardner, broadcasting from Fool Global Headquarters here in Alexandria, Virginia. Here each week to talk money and investing. We are a Motley show, and on this week's show, we're going to talk to a very motley guy, A.J. Jacobs, the author of the book, The Know-It-All, and a guy who read the encyclopedia, This Is True, from A to Z. We'll also play our game of Fool Fact or Fool Fiction, but we begin this week's show by talking movies.
Learn to know the dark side of the Force, and you achieve a power greater than any Jedi.
Yes, the new Star Wars film, Revenge of the Sith, opened this week, and it got us thinking about the business of blockbusters. Okay, maybe it didn't, but that's what our economics contributor, Charlie Whelan, wants to talk about. Charlie Whelan is the author of Naked Economics, Undressing the Dismal Science. He joins us from the NPR Bureau in Chicago, Illinois. Charlie Whelan, welcome back to the Motley Fool Radio Show.
Good to be with you.
Charlie, it's the opening weekend for the new Star Wars film, Revenge of the Sith. It's a movie that many are predicting to be a blockbuster. What are the economics behind movie blockbusters?
Well, the notion of the summer blockbuster movie or several summer blockbuster movies is now about three decades old, and it really was kicked off in part by the original Star Wars. Most people point to Jaws in the early 70s as the first big summer cultural event, and then Star Wars came shortly thereafter, another huge cultural event, blockbuster in the financial sense, followed by E.T. and some others that of my generation really are salient memories from our childhood. And so now that's become a part of Hollywood economics, that summer is the time when you make really big action-packed movies, extremely expensive, but in the hopes that they recoup far more at the box office, that these can be $200 million movies that turn around and make $1 billion by the time you count merchandising and DVD sales and foreign sales and so on. So these are big gambles with potentially huge payoffs.
Any predictions on the performance of Revenge of the Sith?
Well, I'm not a huge Star Wars fan. I did like the original movie. I think one of the things you see with a lot of these blockbusters or movies that the studios would like to become blockbusters is they become a little bit homogenized. If you talk to film purists, they will point to the blockbusters in the 1970s in particular as the decade that ultimately ruined film, or at least ruined the summer experience. And the reason for that is if you're going to invest $100 million or $200 million, then what you start to do is weave in things that you think are going to be audience pleasers. But it's a little bit like picking the buffet or the dinner entree for a big banquet. You drop the seafood because some people are allergic. You don't serve veal. And in the end, you get a little chicken breast. And so there's some concern that these movies have become too formulaic. And if you remember the original Jaws and Star Wars, those were really fresh, creative, new kinds of movies. I'm not sure the studios are willing to be that creative and new, ironically, in the pursuit of the new blockbusters. Mm.
What type of movie offers the best return on investment? We're looking at the finances here of movies.
Well, this is a paradox because I'm convinced that there's room for a Billy Bean of Hollywood. And you folks, I'm sure, have talked about Moneyball, which is a very interesting book about Billy Bean and the Oakland Athletics not having a big payroll and turning to statistics to figure out where they can invest in players, for example, drafting college players instead of high school stars to get a better return. And indeed, Oakland turns out to be a terrific ball club as a result. Well, in Hollywood, one of the mysteries that's still unsolved is why they don't make more G-rated movies. So the one place where you can get the best return on investment is making these family G-rated movies. And so the question is, why doesn't Hollywood make more of them? Anytime you have low-hanging fruit, high returns, you would expect the market to kind of move in that direction. It generally doesn't. I can say as a parent, there are long stretches where there are no G-rated movies at all playing. And I'm saying that in downtown Chicago. So if they're not playing here, they're probably not playing anywhere. And so outside of the holidays and the summer season, there are times when I just can't take my kids to the movies. So that remains one of those conundrums. And my question is there some studio chief who's going to do for movies what Billy Bean did for baseball and start crunching those numbers and producing things that have a more proven return on investment?
You want to take a quick swipe at why you think there's not enough G-rated content out there?
I'm just speculating, but I think there it's a less sexy endeavor. The animated pictures aside, so we know the Pixar, those are really blockbusters of their own because that animated process is so expensive. But some of the movies that are relatively low-key, where they're not animated, where they're kind of the family fair with the dogs and the talking animals and the uplifting story about rescue and things like that, that's not something that's going to capture stars. It's not as sexy for the studios putting them together or the producers. So I'm assuming that there's some cachet lacking with those movies. But it's also a money-driven business, so I can't really answer that question in the end.
Speaking of money, that's the topic here on the Motley Fool Radio Show. We're talking about the economics of Hollywood with Charlie Whelan. Charlie, movie ticket prices keep going up. Is there elasticity of price here in economic terms? I mean, will people pay almost anything for a movie ticket?
I think they might in just a few select circumstances. So if you're a complete Star Wars nut and you really want to be out there for the first night of Revenge of the Sith, that you could easily pay $100, $120. It'd be like a ticket for a Broadway show. But shortly after that, I think there clearly is a limit. Now, one conundrum is why you don't see more creativity in pricing.
And that was what I was wondering, because, and this is one of my pet topics here, Charlie. You and I may have discussed in the past. One of my favorite ideas is that airlines, they need some more profit. It seems to me I would pay more to sit next, in my case, to the window than a middle seat or the aisle than the middle seat. Or if you put me in that back row where I cannot recline my chair at all and I'm right next to the bathroom, I would prefer to pay less. I'd be willing to pay more up front. There doesn't seem to be any creativity in airline seat pricing, and I'm thinking the same about movies in some ways.
Well, first to the point about airlines, when I was writing for The Economist, we actually ran an editorial arguing that children's tickets should be more expensive, not less expensive, because they were the ones screaming on the plane. And actually called for putting all the seats in the back of the plane for small kids.
It's a great
idea. It got more vitriolic mail than all the articles about guns and abortions and politics and things like that. I mean, this is one that hit a nerve. And it was, but it was semi-serious. I mean, the kids are the ones with the negative externality. They're yelling, you want to be away from them. But yeah, I think that in other aspects of the economy, in terms of using the internet, we see all kinds of variable pricing and price discrimination that's very creative. And ultimately, it raises more revenue because you can squeeze as much money out of somebody as they're willing to pay. We see almost no creativity on the theater pricing model. So you don't pay more for a better seat. So if you're stuck there in the front row craning your neck to see the screen, it's not going to cost you less than if you're right in the middle of the theater. We do discount tickets for matinees, but that's kind of an old-fashioned notion. Tickets don't get cheaper the weeks out after something's been released. So it would make sense that the Revenge of the Sith should be most expensive now and next week, and then less expensive 3 and 4 weeks from now. We don't do that. We don't charge for premium kinds of seats. I mean, there is no first class equivalent. So it seems like in an industry, at least the theater goers are struggling for revenue, that they could be more creative about who they charge what, and that might squeeze some more money out of the same number of moviegoers.
Charlie, we understand that you've done some screenwriting yourself. Could you briefly share your experience and give us a flavor of some of Charlie Whelan's screenwriting?
Well, the film that I actually sold, or the screenplay that I actually sold, is an action-adventure story about a Secret Service agent whose job is to protect the president by being the outside force that's always looking for a way to get to the president. So if the president comes to a parade in Chicago, this is the guy who's working on the outside to find the hole in the security, and then they can fix it. But of course, he gets blackmailed, and he at that point is the best person in the world at assassinating the president, and he's now been taken over to the dark side. I started writing these things when I was doing my dissertation because it was such a relief to just sit down and make things up.
And but, Charlie, this all begs the question, what has happened to that screenplay? I mean, not many of us have actually ever sold a screenplay. What happens at that point?
What has happened to that screenplay is exactly what happens to so many screenplays, is that it was actually purchased by a production company. They now own it. I don't even own the property anymore, but they've done nothing with it. So there is this inventory of screenplays that have been bought by studios but not produced. In fact, that number of those screenplays far exceeds those that actually seized the screen. So it's just sitting out there, and who knows what will happen down the road.
Charlie, you may be being modest here, but I also understand that you cooked up a screenplay involving the Federal Reserve chairman.
Well, you know, this speaks to why some of the not that my movies are going to become blockbusters, but why some movies become a little homogenized, which is that when you're making such huge investment, you want to get certain formulaic pieces in place, because Hollywood is often described as the industry that tries to give people what they want and then hopes they like it. And my experience had to do with a screenplay. I'd just done the pitch for it, so I'd come up with the idea that involved a group of bad people, investors, who were going to make a lot of money by making the Fed chief sick. They were going to basically put some stuff in his food, and he was going to pass out in the course of a public speech. The markets would panic. They would have sold the market short. They'd make a lot of money on the fall. And then when the Fed chief recovers, they buy back into the market and they make a lot of money going back up. Now, this is actually based in fact, because I used to go down and cover the Board of Trade when I was with The Economist. And I asked those guys, what was the craziest day you can ever remember down here? And they said it was the day that George Bush, the first George Bush, passed out in Japan. Remember, he'd thrown up on the Japanese prime minister. He passed out. The word was he's just got food poisoning. The markets were not convinced. They thought that he was having a heart attack and that Dan Quayle would soon ascend to the presidency. And so that does not turn out to be true. So you have the markets with a big drop, big comeback. So I go into a Hollywood studio and I pitch this idea. You know, these folks, they make the Fed chief sick, but the twist is, when he falls over, he hits his head on the podium and dies. So they've now accidentally killed the Fed chief. They turn on themselves. It becomes one of those black movies where they ultimately get caught and self-destruct. So I pitch this, and the guy, you know, and it is true. There are these 23 and 24-year-old junior studio executives, and he says, oh, great idea. I love the idea. Do you think you could make it a romantic comedy? And I'm thinking to myself, not verbalizing, okay, well, they kill the Fed chief. They turn on themselves. But of course, my answer was, oh, yeah, that'll be very easy. And sure enough, by the time I repitched it, and by the time it was done, I think I had Danny DeVito playing the Fed chief. But this one obviously has not seen the light of day. But you can see how an idea that has at least some freshness gets bastardized by this need to kind of fill the niche of whatever's in most demand at the moment.
Sounds like all you needed to do is get it rated G.
Exactly. If there were a talking dog in there, totally would have worked.
Charlie Whelan is the author of Naked Economics, Undressing the Dismal Science. He helps us break down the economics of our culture and our life on this show. Charlie Whelan, thanks for joining us, and enjoy your weekend.
Great to be with you, as always.